accession number 19929, reel 2.
Can I tell the reel 2?
Right. Well, you see, the first show after Sekijin, everybody thought I was a goner, but there I turned up. And then this second time, you see, definitely I'd been left behind. But no, again I turned up, and they were getting fed up with this. They preferred to write their own story than be contradicted. So anyway, we went to this Broadway place, and were flown out, where we were put to bed, the Home Valley Brigade, for a week, just to recover, because we were completely emaciated. You see, you were living on these K rations with occasional additions of sugar and that sort of thing from supply drops. I haven't even mentioned supply drops, sorry. Supply drops. And you didn't know you were exhausted until you saw somebody who was more normal. And then you realised that you were. And I think it was rather idiotic, in fact absurd, for us to be sent straight from marching in straight into this attack on Indore, although the Queen's Leicester's nearly did pull it off. Also, I think, in reflection, the marching was another waste of time.
Why?
Because, you see, they flew in before we'd really done anything. They flew in. Could have flown in anyway, perhaps.
So, what unit of the Chindits were you in to start off with before you went to 77th Brigade?
Well, first of all, 45 Recce became 45 Column and 54 Column. 45 Column commanded by the CO, and 54 by the second in command of the original outfit. We still remain 45 Recce as a regiment. All the regiments are the same, split into two columns. So, 45. Still. And I made 45 Recce till we became 16 Parachute. That was something else later on. Yes, it's.
What did the attitude of the villagers seem to be?
Well, they were fairly friendly, but quite frightened. I mean, the people I spoke to got water from telling us that the Japanese were there. Well, frightened. I mean, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. But I don't know whether they would or wouldn't have betrayed you. I suppose we call it betrayal from their point of view. I don't think they like the Japanese very much. Must have been very strange for them to see African soldiers and everybody else strange. Anyway.
What was your own attitude towards the Japanese enemy at the time?
Well, everybody. It's interesting, you see, they were subhuman, therefore they were invincible. It's almost the same as being Superman, to be subhuman. And people had this feeling, you see, it was strange, you know, different, and marvelous soldiers, they'd be everywhere. So, on the whole, well, I should say afraid of them is perhaps not the right word, but anyway, we certainly thought they were bloody good soldiers. I remember reading a book written by some Jeffrey Dunnett who'd learned Japanese in order to be interpreted, and then he got caught in Burma, and instead of what you think they're saying is, now how shall we kill him, or shall we torture him, or whatever, they were saying, how exciting, do you think he's an important person, because this chap knew what they were saying. You know, big car, important chap, do you think, whereas we would have thought they were saying, now, how are we going to kill them? Because they seem quite different. And that was the angle on them. Strange one.
How much do you think the Chindits achieved?
It's always an argument. I think, or thought, was that a waste of time? Really. But they didn't really achieve. We wandered around and wandered around. Some of the other ways, absolutely wandered around and around. And then we had to pull out. we were very lucky in that respect. We were lucky in that having walked in, we were exhausted, so we were flown out. But the other people, like 77 Brigade, had to go on fighting under still of all ghastly experiences. And they had a hell of a time before they came out. There was Calvert, of course, who was very good. And, of course, when Wingate was killed, that was another thing. We all loathed Wingate. Did not like him, his style, anything about him. But when he was killed, I thought, oh, my God, because he had all these contacts, direct to Marshall, direct to Churchill, direct to Mountbatten, and if you want anything, I can get it. and Slim backed him and all that. And if he had lived, they'd never have been shoved under stool to fight the rest of the campaign. I think he was clever in some respects. His supply dropping technique, he was first in the field with that particular thing. And also, we had RAF officers with each column to do the talking down for the airplanes for close support. We had our private American Air Force under General Colonel Philip Cochrane. It was extraordinary thing. He came on a sort of contract for a year, and they were marvellous and innovative and everything else, and then when the year was up, they all went. But they invented all sorts of things like snatching gliders. If you can imagine sort of thing across here. Well, the glider effect, I think, this chap, a picture. I had to look at this to try and remember what the heck went on.
This is a book called To Be a Chindit.
Yes, it's very good. He is actually in our column, this chap.
What's his name? Philip Sharp.
Philip Sharp, yes. Here, I'll give you his address. Right? Because actually, that's from you. He must have kept a diary or something. I don't know how that he could. He was one of our signalers.
This is a letter from him to you?
Yes, because I wrote him on the book. So, but if you'd like to take the address too.
Did you actually meet Wingate himself?
Not to shake hands, I saw him, he'd address troops, that sort of thing.
What impression did he make when he appeared?
Theatrical. He had a beard, which, you know, not our normal form. Of course, I left our beards. And he wore a solar topia, a sort of a pre-war pattern, you know, it seemed centuries, and a fly whisker, making a sort of personality out of himself.
Is that why he wasn't liked?
Well, it was his general way of... He was a rude chap, you know, that sort of thing. Dictatorial. And, of course, a bit unpredictable. But he... Yes, I mean, people say he was a genius. I don't know, he had some very good ideas, but... He was terrified if this thing wasn't going to come off. It nearly didn't, because when they were looking at the aerial photographs, they suddenly saw a whole lot of activity in one of the places, which was going to be Broadway, the landing place. And they thought, oh my God, they've felled trees to prevent us getting in. They know about us. So they took a chance on it, and it was wood felling, ordinary wood felling. But I mean, he had a fit if it hadn't gone through. He was a very strange chap.
What were you going to say about Beards?
Who?
Beards?
Oh, Beards, yes. Yes, well, when we set off in 16 Brigade, it was allowed everybody could grow a beard. And this was supposed to be a great idea. And Bernard Fairs himself had a marvellous beard which used to comb out every day. But the average chap of 18, 19 doesn't grow a very good beard. A funny ginger sprouting. And in my opinion, what was that he put in the anti-mosquito cream? It had a bad effect, really. And I count my praises because I was made company commander after the first thick of gin business. Principally because I shaved every day. So I knew I couldn't grow a good beard, so I shaved instead. And the result of that was I felt I looked half human, whereas the others looked terrible. I thought it was a very great mistake. You want to be clean and fit and that sort of thing.
And Mike Calvert, did you have contact with him?
Yes. And I've seen him since until he died the other day. Yes. He was an extraordinary fellow in another way. He was as brave as a lion. Well, I'm not saying the others weren't. And even, I believe, when they were establishing the White City, was even in personal contact, you know, with his men. But he was... Well, what do you describe? When he gave his orders to us, when he flew out and gave his orders for us to go and do this attack on the people attacking him, he said, well, the order of march will be 45 column or whatever, etc., and then the Gurkhas and so on. And when you get up there, then the Gurkhas will go, and then you all come in. Oh, yes, great. So, we understand that you've booby-trapped all the ways in. You can tell our booby-traps because they're tied with blue ribbon. Well, they're all good fun, because you're only 31 or 32, of course. It's good fun, you know, but you don't feel really confident of getting in or getting anywhere. In fact, what happened was the Gurkhas did do that. They shot each other up and fell
made
back.
Made a pincer movement, in other words.
Well, tried to, yes, but didn't succeed. But on the other hand, the brigadiers coming up on the walk, march from that thing, everybody stepped lighter. They knew he was there. And when they pulled out, when I was on the wrong side of the chomp, there they were, what they thought they were, in a sort of huge Japanese ambush, which to some extent it had been so. He said, well, I think we better go, but we'll brew up first. They brew up in the middle of the thing, but it worked. See, they brew it up, they had their tea, and then off they went. And it's the sort of chap he was, and with his personality, you see. If the brigadier said it's all right.
So you felt there was a lack of precision about him?
Yes, he wasn't a staff officer.
It was a question of organisation, in other words.
He was a leader, yes. Yes, well, she's got to start to do the thing normally. But in this particular case, I thought the orders were left a little wide. Yes.
How long did you have any permanent after effects of being a chindit?
No, that's interesting. For example, they did get a lot of Bill Hart's show. I didn't get personally didn't have any. There's this, I think it's here, this famous, famous to me, may not be, probably isn't.
We'll look at this later, the book, but if you could, the question I asked you was about the any long-term effects on you.
No, none.
Any psychological or mental effects?
We didn't go for that in those days.
What happened to you after the Chindits?
Yes, well, then we remained. We've been shoved in the 77 Brigade. Remained doing Chindit sort of training as though there was going to be a third expedition, which I really was all mad. And while that was going on, we were really rather wasted. That's two British battalions and a Gurkha battalion. And when Major General Down flew in to us in our camp in India and said, I'm now going to raise a parachute brigade. And I want volunteers and so on. So everybody said, to hell with this. And we gave a sort of drinks party that night. And I was pushing saying, you've got it all wrong. You see, what you've got to do is to say, you are parachute regiment, but anybody may volunteer out. 2 days later, this plane arrived and I said, my God, Taylor, you've done it first. And that's what he did. So I got some good advice from him. I said, Lars, I have permission now to say you are now the 15th, that's the King's, and the 16th, by this time, South Stevens, which will become battalions of the pleasurism. And so we went up to Pindit for our parachute training.
Which battalion of the parachute regiment were you?
16th. Very few rounds. The 15th for King's, 16th for South Stafford's, which we had become because the period of getting men back who'd been abroad a long time had started, and South Stafford's had been a long time, so we rather filled in their vacancies. And then having gone back to England. And so we did all that and became parachutists. But, and you know, parachute, sixth level, they were beginning to come over from Europe, you know, we were going to assault and all the rest of it. When the bomb went off, in fact, the general in there, Sadagashi, I think, he had 150,000 troops in fine order. He refused to surrender. And so the emperor had to send a representative to order him to surrender. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done that. That would have taken a long time. And so that was when several of us were together with a signal sergeant and a medical sergeant and one officer from the parachute battalions to be deposited over Southeast Asia in the camps and so on, make sure we're taken over and so on, and then organise medical aid or whatever was required. And I was sent to Malaya to... actually, quite interesting. We didn't know whether we were going to parachute or whether, but in fact, we landed in Singapore. And the tallest building there was the Cathay building. I suppose it was about 10 stories high. I'd never been to Singapore recently. Well, 10 stories is like, I mean, everybody thinks skyscraper. But, and so I went to Moa, which is Moa on the south east coast, to these bandits known as the All Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army. And every time, because the trouble, which really stemmed all the troubles from Malaya later, was trouble in Indonesia. The Dutch, of course, thought they were loved in Indonesia, but they actually hated. And we kept having to send units down through Malaya into Indonesia, who should have been systematically in Malaya. And every time they went, like my place, they went through, as soon as they disappeared, the communists started up again. Doing all their tricks of the trade, and then another unit would come in, and they'd shut up for a bit. But they were founding their postal organisation.
Mua?
Well, Mua was where I was, but they're doing it all over the place.
So, were you in action against the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese
Army? No. I was one of them. I was a liaison officer with them. Which is the social writer say for Spencer Chapman. So, no. There was no fighting in Malaya. Once the troops arrived there, they shut up. But what they were doing was, of course, getting their grip on the place for afterwards. And eventually, they we had a big parade in our case. I was made to lead because they said you're supposed to be a regular officer, you've got to lead it. So I was marching past a chap dressed as a brigadier. He was really amazing. And two of these chaps on either side are giving the communist salute.
The clenched fist.
Yes. And then they stood down, and they were to be given, in exchange for a weapon, they'd be given $750 and a ribbon band, you know, showing the war on Southeast Asia and all this. Well, you gave them the money, and they went around the corner and handed it into what they called the Old Comrades Association. So what we were doing, we were funding them for afterwards. As for the ribbon, one chap stuck it on his backside and he just got about right. But most of those chaps were terrified. You know, they weren't natural banded or anything. They just got co-opted in, and they were terrified of their leaders and what they would do.
How did you know that?
Because I got an interpreter, which I was subsequently rather sorry for, I think, because I didn't trust that interpreter at all. So I got a chap, and he told me that, you know, that they were all fine. Well, he wrote me a letter. I was home and it stopped. Well, I reckon they probably bumped him off.
You mean the letter just stopped?
Sure. Yes, I mean, it's just like that, in the middle of the letter, but nevertheless it arrived, but in the middle of a sentence, which was odd. So now you're going to do about it, because it's in England.
How did you find that interpreter?
Mine?
Yes.
He was very good.
No, how did you discover him?
Oh, I see. Well, there was a schoolmistress in Moore, English, who I visited to see how she was. And I made some Malay friends when I was there, and they said, oh, yes, she used to be a hefty woman anyway. She was absolutely nothing, you know, almost a walking skeleton. But she recommended this chap as one of her pupils, as had been a small boy. And so that's how I got him.
Was he Chinese?
Chinese, yeah.
And you said that most of them are members of this Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army were of that type, but did you come across any of the more dedicated ones?
The leaders, they're all Chinese, really. I mean, they said all Malayan people. I mean, there may have been a couple of Malays somewhere, but all Chinese, right on. The leaders... The absolute leader was a sort of dedicated communist, the most boring man on earth. On and on he used to go. But the second in command was a bandit. And he was quite a good chap. I could have a drink with him. He wasn't quite sure if he wouldn't take his pistol out and shoot in the air or you or something. But the leader was always on. They were always having to listen to these lectures on communism, on the Great China and all the rest of it. And that's unfortunately the American aircraft always have a star. Those are our airplanes, and of course they had three stars representing the Malays, the Chinese, and what are called others, you know, Tamils and so on. And so, no, I didn't think anything apart from the leader. I didn't think anything was dedicated.
And when you said the second in command was a real bandit, what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, he had the elements of being a bandit. He was a fairly tough guy, festooned in weapons. But he was all reasonable. You know. I remember trying to teach him, a couple of planters had come back and some of them, lyre dice. He got it very quickly. You could hear click, 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 till everything was aces. But the only time he was worried was when I took his photo. He didn't like that. I didn't think about it. I just thought it was a memento. But he didn't think about it.
So did he prevent you taking it?
He asked me for it. And I think I gave it to him, actually. Yes, I'm sure I did. No, my only adventure with them, properly, was at the end. They started to bring them all in to central points where they would have the stand down parade and so on. Moore's place, now it's got a bridge, but it was always a ferry in those days. And about half of them had gone across when suddenly I heard I was urgently wanted down the ferry. So I went down, and suddenly a whole bloody lot aiming their rifles at me in a circle. I thought, well, they'd all kill each other, but no help to me. What's it all about? You know, you talk like this. What's it all about? He says, well, you know, you talk in a stupid way. So he says he wants to know that he can keep his present house as headquarters for the old comrades. I said, well, we'll go back and I'll ring up my headquarters and find out. So I rang up and this major at the other end said, can you hear all right? Yes. He says, in no circumstances will they be allowed to have that house. Is that clear? I said, absolutely clear. It's okay. The house is yours. Oh, I thought, well, bugger them, I'm going back to England at home.
Why did you do that?
Well, because I'm going home, I'm not going to be shot here. And of course, what harm could it have done? But It was typical that chap Wilkinson on the other end. The leader, there was another thing. So I took over from a Canadian team who'd been parachuted in before. And they got hold of a rather good car, some Ford thing. And the leader wanted that car. And I promised him, you'll have it. Well, you can't have it tomorrow, but you'll have it next week, I promise you. He never got it. And he couldn't believe that the English officer wouldn't keep his word. He said, I said, yes, you think we're all mugs, but you're wrong. We're quite prepared. And that was my... I was really, really proud of it. He just didn't get the car.
How long were you at Muir Fall?
With them.
Yes, as a liaison officer.
Yes, I suppose from about 5 or 6 months. Yes.
In 45?
Yes. In 45, they went back to the parachute battalion in Quetta. That's right. December. Yeah, that would be about August, December. About.
So, what did you do between in 46 and 47 before you went back to the millennium to deal with the millennium emergency?
Oh, well, then, of course, I go to the. So I can get this right. Then I got sent to the gas school, God help us. Yes, so then I got back to our first West Yorkshire First Battalion, which was reforming in Scotland and was going to half reform, go by ship to Austria via Naples. Rather strange. And there we would form up with one of our, what was the second, fifth? Actually, who were there already before the 60s. So this is rather fun, because you can imagine, I mean, this is the quickest way to go to Austria, but it was jolly nice. We had about 5 weeks in Naples, Capri and everything, and then into the train into Austria, which of course was a marvellous thing. I hadn't wanted to go there, but boy, it was wonderful, because the Austrians were liberated. They were judged as having been invaded. Anybody could see the photographs of them waving to Hitler could realize it was a warm welcome. And this meant that you could fraternize. You were allowed to fraternize with girls or anything like that, but you weren't allowed to do at that time in Germany. And so that made for much easier living conditions there. Very nice. And so we went there to Brook, Graz. And used to do tours in Vienna. And then I became a staff officer, headquarters British Troops Austria, PTA, in Vienna.
Did you come across this phenomenon of the East Europeans being sent back from Austria?
Yeah, well, we arrived, I suppose, couldn't have been more than a month after it happened. And it was appalling, everybody said, it was a ghastly. And the poor Cossacks, yes. And we, having to man light machines, make it, not we weren't there, but others. Yes, and it was awful. And they could hear, for example, the Russians had to go back. First, they were well into our what was eventually our zone, a place called Judenberg. And Judenberg was where we pushed these chaps back, and you could hear, apparently, I'm quoting it. Yeah, the firing going on all night and all day as they were shooting these guys. Yeah. Yeah, then on the spot. And in my opinion, Tolstoy got it right, and Lord, what's his name, was the villain, a villain.
Aldington, I think.
Aldington, that's right, Toby Lowe. It's interesting, you see, the way it's done, subversion is not done or anything by the general. He knows nothing about what's going on.